Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at 110 The Embarcadero, the Commonwealth Club's new home. And I'd also like to welcome our radio and online audiences. Today, it's my great pleasure to introduce Richard Munson. He is the author of Tesla, Inventor of the Modern. He also has written other scientific biography books, and he is the Environmental Defense Fund's Clean Energy Efforts Coordinator in the Midwest. So, Richard, thanks a lot for coming. Let's hear a little bit about this genius.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you, George. Appreciate the introduction. And I must say, I also greatly appreciate the Commonwealth Club's invitation. It's quite an honor to be here. We are here to talk about Nikola Tesla, and I would suggest that he has benefited a bit in the recent years from a sort of a popular revival. Obviously, Elon Musk's car and company have brought his name back, but also a shining technological light, particularly in San Francisco. Larry Page, Google's co-founder, refers to Nikola Tesla as his hero. So with that, I was starting to ask people what they know about Nikola Tesla, and I must say there seems to be sort of two different camps. There's the one camp that thinks that he is basically a Superman, this fantastic inventor, this icon, this legend who can do absolutely nothing wrong. There's this other sort of camp that thinks that he's a little eccentric, kind of quirky in some ways, and he does have some. There's no doubt about that. He abhorred jewelry on women. He would start getting a fever if he looked at a peach. He would have to count his steps, and if they were not divisible by three, he'd have to start all over again. That said, I think in my opinion, I think he is far more complex, enigmatic, and really far more interesting than either of those two paradigms. He's both a remarkable scientist as well as a fascinating individual, and I think he begins to have us ask questions about how did this immigrant born in a small Croatian village end up being an international intellectual giant, if you will? How did this great scientist who was once quite famous become overlooked for a while, and why is he now coming back? And I also wonder, what does this scientist sort of teach us about some of the scientific challenges that we're facing today and what how we might approach those? So in my biography, I tried to answer some of those questions and add to his popular revival, but mostly to try to portray Nikola Tesla as both a man as an inventor. So what I wanted to do for maybe about 30 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have lots of questions, but to give you, from my perspective after doing the research, sort of five observations or surprises that I had in the course of the research that maybe may help you better understand Nikola Tesla as a man. So number one, I was just struck by the extent of his inventing. He is far less known, in the United States at least, than Edison and Marconi, but this man had more than 300 patents, and he gave us the electric motor, long-distance electricity transmission, radio, remote control, robots, the list goes on, and these are the very foundations of our modern economy. There was the quote from the American Institute of Electrical Engineers said, "Were we to seize and eliminate from our industrial world the result of Mr. Tesla's work, the wheels of industry would cease to turn and our towns would be dark." It's not only these foundations, however, he also just imagined things and brought them to life, I suppose, and opened up the door to inspire great minds over future generations. So he foresaw and he outlined plans for the cell phone, for radar, for laser weapons, artificial intelligence, vertical lift aircraft. The list goes on. So consider radar just for a minute. This is about 100 years ago. Tesla was drawing plans, detailed plans, for how you could send out signals and then receive their echoes on a fluorescent screen. It was only about 20 years after that that the French gentleman who is credited with actually inventing radar said he did his accomplishments only because he relied on the precise apparatus and the principles that were outlined by Tesla. And he had this great line. He said that Tesla may have been dreaming since he had at his disposal no means of carrying them out. But one must add that if he was dreaming, at least he was dreaming correctly. Tesla would admit that no one really understands electricity. We know what it does. Keeps our beer cold, runs our elevators, you know, runs our Tesla cars. But physicists sort of, it still is this mysterious force. Tesla, however, during his time was viewed basically as a magician. He could control this magical force. He could manipulate energy, if you will, at his will. He created lightning. This was something that had been reserved just for nature. He would make lamps glow, even though they were not connected to any wires. So Tesla, of course, in addition to these marvelous magical things, he advanced a few, if you will, quixotic notions that you might say complicate his legacy, or you could say made him more interesting. That would be sort of my view. But, he spent a fair amount of time thinking about how to communicate with intelligent beings on other planets. He spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out how to read your mind by placing monitors next to your retina. He also made mistakes, like all of us, and particularly inventors who were at the cutting edge of their insights. So even after the Wright brothers' flight, Tesla was arguing that airplanes were just too heavy to soar, and he far preferred the dirigibles being developed by Count Zeppelin. Not long after Einstein came up with his theory, he was saying that cosmic rays could travel faster than the speed of light, and that if you split atoms, you wouldn't get any energy. That said, allow me to suggest that Tesla's batting average, if you will, sports analogy, was remarkable. This man brought us the very foundations of our modern economy, and he inspired others to develop an array of devices that today dominate our daily lives. Second observation, I was struck by just the drama, if you will, and the contradictions associated with Tesla's personal life. There are lots of stories that one could tell, and I don't have a lot of time, but let me just try a few. He grew up as a Serb in Croatia in a modest home. Ooh, that was really wrong. How did we get there? We must be missing some slides. We'll forget that. He did grow up in a modest home, and it was not there. we'll stay with this one. Yeah, that's right. His father was an Orthodox priest, and they had he oversaw a small, isolated church, and it is now a popular tourist park in that section of the world where, to be honest, Tesla is far more famous than Marconi or Edison. He claimed that his early years were blissful. He was doted over by two older sisters. He rode the family farm animals. He had what he referred to as the greatest cat in all the world. That blissfulness, and this would come back in a different way later, it ended when Nikola was 7 years old. His older brother, whose name was Dane, had been Nikola's idol and also had been the family favorite. He was considered gifted to an extraordinary degree, and everybody expected Dane would follow his father's footsteps and go into the clergy. Yet when Dane was 12 years old, and Nikola being about 7, the family's Arabian stallion bolted and threw the young lad, and he died that evening from his injuries. So imagine this young Tesla, 7 years old, witnessed his brother being thrown, and then his mother, in the middle of the night, grabbed him from bed and dragged him over to kiss his dead brother. And even 55 years later, Tesla would write that my visual impression of my brother's death has lost none of its force. So you would think that the family would now say, all right, we've got Nicola, our surviving son. Let's nurture him, and he's going to be our guy. No. They increasingly idolized the dead boy's talents and consistently projected accomplishments if only he had lived. So Nicola, he could not compete with such an ideal. He was bright. I mean, he eventually could speak 8 languages fluently. He could recite long poems, from memory. He could do short stories from memory. But he would write, anything I did that was credible merely caused my parents to feel their loss more keenly. I grew up with little confidence in myself. To earn his father's respect, Tesla developed, in his words, many strange likes, dislikes, and habits. In addition to some of the quirks that I mentioned at the beginning, this gentleman, who was born during a violent lightning storm, he would have these episodes of seeing things with strobing intensity. And so the images that he was seeing, he could not tell whether they were real or whether they were fake. He even had vivid daytime and nighttime dreams in which he would travel to foreign lands where he had never been and meet friends that he thought were as real as any friend that he had in the real world. All sounds weird, but he, Nicola, looks back on that and thought that such strange visions allowed him to vividly see and manipulate inventions in his head. His father demanded that he become a priest. Nicola wanted to become an engineer. And he relented. This is one of my favorite. Nicola, who was suffering from cholera, basically on his deathbed, sort of turns to his father, choking, I might be able to recover if you let me go to engineering school. and he got to go. And he had perfect marks for like 2 years, and brought in every possible accomplishment that you can imagine. But it was, the parents kept saying, Dane would have done better. And so he, Nicola, basically quit school. He took up gambling and billiards. He moved away to a different town. He got arrested for vagrancy, and he was brought back by the police to his parents. All right, think about that. Bad scene. And sorry to say, as you, I'm not saying that you could imagine this, but it was a huge disappointment, obviously, and his father died about 9 months after that, in large part, I think, from the sheer disappointment. Switching to his first real job was to install, Edison phone systems in both Budapest and in Paris. What he was really doing was trying to figure out the wonders of electricity. He was trying to imagine an electric motor. And it was while in Budapest, and this is, just demonstrates his genius and his mixing of science and the humanities, while he was walking through a Budapest park at sunset, quoting Goethe's Faust, he imagined his revolutionary electric motor and grabbed a stick and drew the design in the gravel. How weird is that? He was recognized for his ingenuity by his European supervisors, and so he was sent to New York to work for the great man himself, Thomas Edison. Tesla's European supervisor wrote probably the greatest letter of recommendation ever written. This was a letter to Thomas Edison, and it said, I know of 2 great men. You are one of them, and the other is this young man. No one has ever written a letter like that. These 2 great men, however, did not hit it off. They clearly had different styles, and Edison appeared rather rumpled and crass, while Tesla, he was this cosmopolitan. He spoke 8 different languages, and he usually dressed like he was going to the opera. And they also just had totally different views of the world, and particularly the science world. Tesla felt that transmitting electricity should be done by alternating current because it could go farther, and Edison was stuck with thinking about keeping it as a direct current, which was more controllable and more safe, at least in his eyes. They split, however, when Nikola thought that Edison had promised him a bonus if he had increased the efficiency of the Edison generators. And so Tesla worked on the evenings, he worked on the weekends, probably for about 6 months, and he tripled the output of these Edison motors. So he goes to the great man, and he says, I'd like my bonus. And in a slight that can only hurt so much if you are an immigrant, Mr. Edison turns to him and laughs and said, when you become a full-fledged American, you will appreciate an American joke. Tesla did not laugh. He picked up his bowler hat, basically, and headed out the door and started his own company building a street lighting firm in Rahway, New Jersey. Unfortunately, in what would become sort of a pattern, Nikola Tesla was a brilliant scientist. He was a horrible businessman and negotiator. He basically got taken advantage of by his investors, and he spent the next year digging ditches in New York City, making $2 a day. He was not your typical ditch digger. He would give advice to the supervisor. They were digging ditches so that they could send telegraph lines across the city. Nikola kept coming up with ideas about how to do it more efficiently. And so suddenly they thought, not typical ditch digger. This guy might have something. And in fact, his whole life changed when he found a lawyer who was willing to help him sell his electric motor patents to George Westinghouse and then help the Pittsburgh industrialist win the contract to light the Chicago Columbian Exposition in 1893 and then to transmit power from Niagara Falls all the way to New York City. We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a second. Tesla became a celebrity and a rather wealthy inventor. He moved into the fancy Waldorf Astoria. He ate filet mignon at Delmonico's virtually every night. And he befriended the likes of Mark Twain, John Muir, a whole variety. He was at the top of his game, and yet we're back to blissfulness. He had it, and it went away. Because early in the morning on March 13, 1895, his Fifth Avenue laboratory burned to the ground. He lost everything. He lost his equipment. He lost his notes. He, as you might imagine, fell into a debilitating depression, which he battled, as you might imagine, through electricity, or more appropriately, through electrotherapy. He struggled back, but slowly. He did some advanced work on radio, developed the first generation of robots, but he focused more and more on what he decided was his one big idea, and this was to send electricity through the planet and then make it available to everybody around the world virtually for free. He spent almost all of his money that was remaining building a tower in Colorado Springs and then a larger one on Long Island that sent electricity bursts into the earth, but unfortunately, it just never worked out. So he spent his final years declaring bankruptcy, begging for investments from ruthless bankers like J.P. Morgan, prophesizing to reporters every year at his birthday, they would all assemble, and he spent increasingly amounts of time as he was isolated feeding and taking care of pigeons. He died alone in the Hotel New Yorker in 1943, 75 years ago, but more than 2,000 people attended his services at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. So my third observation, as was mentioned, I have a day job at the Environmental Defense Fund. Some of my colleagues are here. Nice to see you. And my job is to try to promote clean energy, and I do that particularly in Midwestern states. So it was a treat for me to realize that Nikola Tesla was actually a clean energy pioneer. He remains sort of an inspiration, if you will, to many of today's solar and battery entrepreneurs. Elon Musk, we've mentioned before, also refers to him as a hero and recently contributed $1 million to restore Tesla's laboratory up on Long Island. He marked his clean energy leadership with an article in the year 1900 in a magazine then called The Century, which was the largest circulation periodical at the time. It was entitled "The Problem of Increasing Human Energy," with special references to the harnessing of the sun's energy. So think about this. 118 years ago, this man was giving detailed looks about how to capture power from the sun, from the wind, from the temperature differentials within the Earth. So when I sometimes get depressed about my day job about energy politics, I imagine, I do the daydreams that Nikola Tesla used to do, and I imagine that Tesla was with us today. And what would he do with the electricity industry that he helped found that has now become rather risk and innovation averse? And I think, I don't know, but I mean, he'd probably be sending electricity without wires. He'd be generating it without pollution. He'd be transforming the transportation sector. He'd be making sure that everybody in the world, including the now 1.2 billion people who lack access to electricity, he'd be ensuring that they all had this drudgery-saving benefit. So our fourth observation is that Tesla had this, I guess, need to sort of balance between the present and the future. You could call it apocryphal. You could call it appropriate. You could call it just weird. But this, he was born, this is the man who brought us artificial lightning. He was born during a lightning storm. Not only that, but he was born at the exact stroke of midnight between the 9th and 10th of July, 1856. So this became part of Tesla family lore. Here this was this odd birth, this during a midnight gale, and sort of assured the young boy that he was somewhat special. For me as a biographer, it sort of allowed me to think that he was constantly sort of trying to balance between today and tomorrow. And throughout his life, he would struggle to find that balance of trying to deal with the current realities of life versus trying to envision the future. When he was too stuck in the current, he got bored. When he was too far out here in the future, he was doing wacky things. So how did you find that sort of balance? And so consider his position in 1897. At last, I get to put on the slide. he had just transmitted power from Niagara Falls, first 26 miles to Buffalo, and then a remarkable 400 miles to New York City. You have to think about this at the time. Thomas Edison's direct current approach could move electricity about a half a mile. He and George Westinghouse transmitted this 400 miles, powered the subways, made Broadway the Great White Way. The New York Times referred to this Niagara project as the unrivaled engineering triumph of the 19th century. And the paper declared that to Tesla belongs the undisputed honor of being the man whose work made this Niagara project possible. And there are statues on both the Canadian and the U.S. side. So imagine, we're back to the balance. He just did this remarkable thing, absolutely remarkable. The engineering triumph of the 19th century, and he was bored. So today, done that, too practical. Had to look towards the future. So what did he think of? He wanted to come up with an entirely new field that he called telematonics that we today might refer to as robotics. So the inventor's initial project, I hope this works, a radio-controlled model boat. This thing is about 4 feet in length, maybe about 3 feet high. He was capable of being a showman. Usually he was kind of the shy scientist who was most happy in his laboratory, but he could be a showman. So he arranged this telematon's debut at the massive Madison Square Garden. This is the old one. During the Electrical Exposition in May 1898. Remember, this is about 2 months after the battleship Maine blew up in Havana Harbor. So we were really looking for possible new weapons to win what was to become the Spanish-American War. So the inventor erected a small indoor pond and invited military officers, scientists, reporters, and he spent several minutes tantalizing them by directing this battery-powered boat around the pond, went backwards and forwards, made it dance like, you know, a water bug, if you will. And then, after everybody was just like amazed, the morning papers the day afterwards were filled with these comments from people in the audience, some of whom thought that the boat, you know, was infused with a magical spirit. My favorite one, however, was that one guy thought there was a tiny little monkey inside. It was driving it. So he does this. Everybody's sort of overwhelmed. And then he turns to the crowd and said, "Who wants to ask the boat a question?" And everybody goes, "You know, ask the boat a question." And obviously, you know, some math nerd in the background comes up and says, "What's the cube root of 64? And so Tesla, there he is, with his hand hidden underneath the control panel, punches a little button four times, and so the lights on the boat flash four times. And Tesla admitted, "It created a sensation such as no invention of mine has ever produced." Now, Tesla's success was highlighted even further by Marconi's failure. About 4 months later, Marconi tried something very similar, and he brought in military officials, and he had his little frigate, and at the other end of the pond, he created what he called the Spanish Ship. Again, Spanish-American War, looking for weapons. And he devised his little boat. It would maneuver around and get up right next to the Spanish ship, and it was supposed to blow up, and the Spanish ship would be gone. Unfortunately, Marconi had not realized how to do individualized messages. So when he punched his button to set the bomb off, the Spanish ship was just fine, thank you very much. But there was this massive explosion in the back room where Marconi had kept all of his other little tiny bombs. And debris and noise and smoke just fill the center. So not surprisingly, we're jumping ahead. This is Nikola Tesla. So, you know, people are saying, "Oh, wow, you've got a great radio-controlled model boat," or, "Wow, could this be a marvelous submarine-type creature that would win the war?" What is Nikola Tesla thinking? Boring. What we have here, he says, is the first non-biological form of life. It is a machine embodied with a borrowed mind. That mind, of course, was his. And so foreseeing artificial intelligence, he actually predicted that this telematon not only would follow a course laid out or obey commands given far in advance, but, here's the key part, this is over 100 years ago, but it will be capable of distinguishing between what it ought and what it ought not to do. My fifth and final insight resulted, actually, this is a biographer's joy. I was at the archives at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., and they had brought out a set of papers. They were largely technical papers and schematics of various designs that he had done. I will fully admit I am not an engineer, so a good part of me was a little bored by this. And so I go to the librarian and I say, "Got anything else?" And she says, "There's a few boxes in the back. You want to take a look?" And in them were letters from Nikola Tesla to his friends, to his colleagues, to his patrons. And so this brought out what I think is the totally overlooked side to this remarkable genius. Most articles and other biographies of Nikola Tesla refer to him as a superman, as this, if you will, supernova in the galaxy of the human race. And there's no doubt electric motors, robots, remote control, radio, these are rather super accomplishments. And yet, this man was also human, and charmingly so. His closest friends were the Johnsons. This is Robert. He was the editor of the Century magazine, which I had mentioned before, a large circulation magazine at the time. And Catherine, who operated together an intellectual salon at their stately townhouse in the Murray Hill neighborhood of New York. They were not overwhelmingly wealthy, but they sort of acted that way, and they loved to gather together writers, artists, musicians, thespians, what have you. And one of their regular guests was, who knows this one? Mark Twain. After dinner at this intellectual salon, Mark Twain would go back to Nikola Tesla's laboratory. That's Mr. Tesla there on the left-hand side. And they would be like two guys. They'd be shooting lightning across the room. They'd be taking x-rays of each other's hands. They'd be dancing around with little globes unattached to wires and little sabers, like, you know, from Star Wars, and without wires attached. They were having a gay time. So Tesla's relations with Robert, this is a little bit later picture, and Catherine, reveal a jovial and a relaxed side to this usually intense inventor. They exchanged almost daily notes about the Johnson children, Tesla's latest projects, their health, the writings of other scientists. One of my favorite notes, it just gives you a sense of how kind of close they were and charming this somewhat isolated scientist was. Tesla had been sick for about a week, and so Robert writes to him and says, "It's been a whole week since we saw you, and you need cheering up. Come as early as possible and get cheered. We are in a jolly mood, and the fire is lighted and the hearth, and we only need you." Isn't that nice?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Tesla did not marry. He did have one love of his life, a girl named Anna, and this was at his age of 23. They spent a joyous summer in Austrian parks, walking through them and imagining the family that they would have or the great engineering work that Tesla would do after engineering school. Their relationship, as you might imagine, did not survive engineering school. That said, Nikola Tesla was sort of a flirt in some regards. So the Johnsons, for instance, he had his favorite, you know, female people that he'd like to have come over to this intellectual salon. So he would write to them and said that if a Miss Merrington were to attend, I'd certainly be there and would happily be her victim. But all of this, Tesla argued that an inventor could not marry. He said that matrimony might be acceptable for artists, musicians, or writers. These are sort of the emotional wimps of the world, in his view. But he said, an inventor has so intense a nature, with so much of it of wild, passionate quality, that in giving himself to a woman he might love, he would give up everything and so take everything from his chosen field. Now, one of the saddest letters that I read in these boxes was near the end of his life. He admitted that he still believed that, but he said, "It's a pity, for sometimes we feel so lonely." So this very human scientist, I think at his core, just reveled in the excitement of discovery. These are just a few pictures of him throughout his life. He wrote, "I do not think that there is any thrill that can go through the human heart like that felt by the inventor as he sees some creation of the brain unfolding to success. Such emotions make a man forget sleep, food, friends, love, everything." So Tesla, in my mind, was one of the, I guess, one of the last curiosity-driven inventors. He was motivated by idealism. Edison developed his products largely to make money. He was an entrepreneur. And this is no knock on making money. This is how sort of our system works, and you make progress that way. Tesla, however, believed that technology transcended the marketplace and that invention should not be tied just to profits. So he wrote, "The desire that guides me in all I do is the desire to harness the forces of nature to the service of mankind." So as I think about what lesson might Tesla give to our modern inventing, I have two. He never said this, but these are my ideas. One is that he would argue that to invent, you needed to love both the humanities as well as science. You couldn't have one without the other, as evidenced by his walking through the Budapest park, quoting Goethe's Faust, and he comes up with this revolutionary electric motor. There was an article in the New York Times about 2 or 3 weeks ago by Frank Bruni, suggesting that a lot of U.S. colleges are canceling their humanities majors Tesla would be aghast, suggesting that such a move is so contrary to inventing and possible economic development, and that you need to view nature from multiple perspectives. You need it both from the humanities as well as from science. Secondly, I think he would also be a little concerned about our current reliance upon teams of researchers. There are universities, federal labs, corporate research centers. I was recently on the other side of the country at an MIT conference, and they were bragging that they had this research project. They had 165 researchers on it. Tesla would have gone, what do you do with all those people? You know, and I think what he would suggest is that we are missing the individual in nurturing the individual creative, genius, eccentric, quirky, however you want to define it. And I'm not, you know, in either of these comments, not suggesting that we should, teams have done an amazing amount of wonderful work. I'm just suggesting that Tesla would probably look at them and think, you might need them, but let's also not rule out the individual. So there's no doubt that he aimed high, in my opinion, perhaps higher than any other inventor. He worked tirelessly to bring electric power to the world and to build robots that he thought would reduce life's drudgery. He was, in short, driven by inner forces that made sheer creation the most important thing in his life. And allow me to argue, I think we are all the better for it. So thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Richard Munson speaking about his book, Tesla, the Inventor of the Modern. It's time for Q&A. Who would like to ask a question?
Hi. Thank you for an excellent lecture. I had read that when Westinghouse got in financial trouble, that Tesla gave up all his royalties.
That's an amazing story. If I might. So remember I mentioned that he had gone from ditch digging to selling his patents to George Westinghouse. And included in that was a $2.50 per horsepower royalty on each of the motors. So this allowed him to move into the Waldorf Astoria, eat at Delmonico's. He was doing really well. After they completed the Niagara Falls project, however, Westinghouse was stretched financially a little thin. And J.P. Morgan, ruthless banker that he was, saw an opportunity to take over Westinghouse's company and create, if you will, an electricity equipment manufacturing trust. So Westinghouse realized that he needed to reduce his costs, and one of his biggest costs was this royalty to Nikola Tesla. Nikola Tesla, again, remember, brilliant inventor, horrible businessman and negotiator. He had the patent. He had a contract. And yet he turns to George Westinghouse and says, you have been my friend. You are the one who is going to bring my ideal invention, my electric motor, to the world. How about if I tear up the contract? He lost hundreds of millions of dollars. He never recovered from sort of the financial loss that resulted from that. But it goes back, I think, to his idealism that what he was offering the world was something far more important than simply just profits or riches for himself.
Next question.
Richard, thank you for coming from Chicago. I'm Rob Bramo is my name. I work for Pacific Gas and Electric.
Uh-huh.
I'm a rate engineer from Canada as well. And we have an incredible history in Folsom, the Folsom powerhouse of 1895, transmitting power to Sacramento for the light parade. And we learn a lot about the history of Tesla and Edison. I guess my question is, you mentioned quickly about public policy and the struggles that you see for the NRDC and inventions and creativity. If you could change, one or two things about the environment for creating innovation and solar and batteries and, the duck curve and all the things we hear about, what would be those two things you would change?
My colleagues will make me say that I work for the Environmental Defense Fund, not NRDC, because they're laughing over in the corner. That said, That's a very good question. I guess I would try and focus as much as possible on markets, free them up, and allow the entrepreneurs and the innovators and the inventors to figure out the better mousetrap or way to provide not just electricity, but the services that electricity provides. Is there a better way to cool my beer? Fine, I'll take it. You know, I want cold beer. So I guess that would be my one focus, is to, as much as possible, figure out ways to let the market do what markets do best.
Next question.
There's one here in the front or one in the back. I think he's coming to you next.
I've heard a story about Tesla studying with resonant frequency and something about a building collapsing. Do you have any details on that?
He did have a small device that he called an oscillator, and it was not that large, actually. It's probably as big as this laptop, that in his own laboratory, he attached it to sort of the structural beams of the building, and as he increased the frequency, things began to shake and stuff falls off the shelves. He did not know this, but at the time, as the building began to shake more and more, he actually busted a water pipe in the middle of the street outside his laboratory. And he was in an Italian-American neighborhood in New York, many of the people having come from the Vesuvius area of the country, who suddenly the ground starts shaking and they think, this is not good. So the police are called. And they all, you know, Tesla, of course, is ramping this up. He's having a grand time. He's an inventor. He's a scientist. You know, let's see what we can do. So he keeps drinking this thing up. More water mains break. The police go wild. They come running up, pound on the door, and Tesla suddenly realizes that his lab is falling apart, and the police are knocking at his door. So he picks up a hammer and smashes the living daylights out of his oscillator. And then the police walk in, and he says, oh, must have been an earthquake. Best part is, I mean, he did this. He'd walk around town, you know, particularly on a new building construction. He, you know, kind of slyly walk up, you know, attach, you know, this little oscillator, and the building would start shaking, and all the people who were, you know, up on the scaffoldings came running down, thinking, "What's going on?" Now, admittedly, there's, what was that show? The MythBusters, is that what it was called? A few years ago, they tested this theory that Nikola Tesla could bust down buildings. He said he could, you know, bring down the Brooklyn Bridge within about, you know, 20 minutes. He actually said he could split the earth in two, or at least. So they did. They got an old bridge and they brought this thing out, and they admitted that indeed it did shake a lot, but it was not about to collapse. But how's that for your story? Back to your question.
I have a lousy voice, I'm sorry, but I'm a not entirely reconstructed former New Yorker. And when I was quite small, I and my family lived in a building at 1 East End Avenue in New York, and it was powered by DC. Mm. And my remark is, DC hung on in New York for years and years.
Yes.
Far later, my wife and I were members of St. Thomas Church on 53rd Street, built in 1913 or something. And it, too, had DC running its ancient air conditioning machines.
Yep. Yep.
And so I was witness as a member of the building committee to changing from this beautiful, totally silent DC fan to a modern alternating electricity whiz bang that turned at 5,000 RPM or something and sounded like a Mixmaster. I thought I'd remember this because DC hung on in New York for a long time. And the reason why the St. Thomas changed was because of its terrible cost.
Mm. That's a very good story. The War of the Currents, as it was called, this is the war between Edison and his direct current and Tesla and his alternating current. It actually was, it turned fairly gruesome and gives sort of a not the nicest of portrait of Thomas Edison in the process. He and J.P. Morgan had invested a lot of money in the direct current system, and they were not about to just throw that away, if you will. And so an associate, as it was called, of Edison, wanted to portray alternating current as dangerous. And so they actually brought in all these reporters to witness a dog standing on a stage, and they would attach direct current probes to the dog, and the dog was just fine with direct current. And then they attach, you know, really high voltage, you know, alternating current. The dog obviously did not do well. And they did this for like 20 different animals. I mean, it was gruesome. And Edison himself actually lobbied the New York legislature to, instead of hanging or shooting criminals, to electrocute them. And he would call it Westinghouse. So that you got this sense that alternating current was a dangerous thing that needed to be avoided. It also, though, was a struggle somewhat between your vision of what electricity's role in the future should be. Edison and most others were sort of of the mind that it would be a limited commodity available only to a small number of people rich enough to have alternating current generators in their basement. J.P. Morgan was probably one of the first that had an Edison generator in his basement. And it's a very funny story. Obviously, his next-door neighbor, whose name I can't remember, but it was a Mrs. Johnson or something. She initially complained that the J.P. Morgan generator was vibrating her china. So J.P. Morgan had to come in and put all sorts of sandbags all over the his generator. Then she, about 3 months later, said that the smoke from J.P. Morgan's generator was causing her silver to tarnish. So he had to go off and buy a new, you know, kind of coal. This went on for a long time. The delivery of electricity from Niagara Falls was, in fact, the turning point, because it demonstrated that you could send electricity a long distance. But you're exactly right. It hung on in places where it had been entrenched or in J.P. Morgan's basement. Waldorf Astoria. That's very true. That was the thought.
A lot of stuff.
Very good point. Very good point. Please.
That was my question.
That was a great
question.
I happen to be visiting Belfast, and there, that's where he came from. And there's a very nice museum there where I experienced some of his different devices. Mm-hmm. You've been there, I assume.
It's in Belgrade, not Belfast.
I'm sorry. I said it right. It's in Serbia and not – yes, thank you.
Trust me, there's a whole lot of people who would not be happy with that comment.
Yeah, I'm sure there would. I'm sorry. But anyway, it was quite an interesting experience to experience what I saw there. I thought I'd throw it in.
It was an intriguing part, if I might bridge from that. Tesla died in 1943, which is the beginning of World War II. And this relates to the Belgrade Museum, because there was an effort to try to bring all of his papers to Belgrade or Yugoslavia at the time. And in his later years, I mentioned, like in his 60s and 70s, every year on his birthday, Tesla would have, if you will, a party, and he'd invite reporters to come in and spend 6 hours listening to the great man think about the future. Now, these are like 50 reporters from all the major newspapers, the New York Times, New York Herald, everybody goes to a Nikola Tesla event. You know, and so he's off, you know, sometimes he's talking about crazy things, about his recipe for having good mental health is that you squeeze your toes 100 times before you go to bed. Okay. But he also was describing a death beam, supposedly something that could shoot down flying airplane or knock out battleships or wipe out entire armies. And he spoke about it in enough detail that when he died, the FBI said, we don't really want anybody other than us to be figuring out or have access to death beam schematics. So what did they do? This is the FBI. They hired an MIT professor to come down to New York City. They assembled all of Tesla's papers from all over the place, boxes and of things. And so he spent, I think, 6 full days under the supervision of FBI and naval intelligence going through these papers. And he decided that one in particular was so clear of a schematic for essentially what ended up being Star Wars, like weapons, like what, 20, 30 years, 40 years later, that he slapped a top secret, you know, clearance on that paper. And I think it still has a top secret clearance. The rest of it, he said, were basically the ramblings of, you know, an older gentleman who was talking about squeezing his toes. Here's the key question. Who was the MIT professor? He was a member of the National Academy of Sciences, was awarded as, got the award from the National Academy of Engineering. And his other distinction is that John Trump is uncle to the 45th president of the United States. How's that for?
I am intrigued by a number of things. Part of them is his quirkiness.
Mm-hmm.
But the other question I have is whether or not you have any more stories about him as a little kid. I understand about the big brother and the shadow, but I'm thinking, is this a kid who was always putting stuff together that other people broke? Or maybe there's not much information about, but I'm particularly intrigued by that part of his childhood.
He was a clearly creative child. So he, you know, did a water wheel by a local pond. He actually, I mean, what's really freaky is that he saw a picture of Niagara Falls when he was like, you know, 10 years old, and he said, I'm going to, you know, gain electricity from that. You know, he also, you know, he had weird things, you know, like he thought that he could make a little machine. He would create, he'd find these little beetles that he'd put on a little treadmill, and they'd, you know, sort of run around. The best part is that the town bully decided to eat the beetles. And so that experience sort of just went its way.
Other questions?
There's one right here.
Thank you. I was watching a program on public television, and it was on Hedy Lamarr,
mm-hmm.
where she claimed to have invented, or her son claimed that she had invented some of the harnessing of electricity that would be used to form radar.
Okay.
Do you have any experience with
Absolutely
Hedy?
Nothing. Sorry. Can't go there.
So did he change his mind about airplanes?
Yes, but it took a while. He, you know, this was, you know, fairly late in his life, and I shouldn't say this as I get older, but we become perhaps a little more entrenched in our ways and not open to as many new ideas. Not all of us, of course. But yes, he came around. And in fact, he never sort of came around to Einstein. Einstein to him was just wrong. Einstein was like 20 years his junior. And Tesla had a very 19th century view of electricity. He didn't really understand electrons. You know, he thought that they went through something called the ether, which was this sense that this is what pervaded the entire environment or the atmosphere, if you will. And Einstein basically said there's no reason that we, you know, you don't need the theory of the ether to explain how you transmit signals. So although Einstein, despite the fact that Tesla actually, you know, said some rather blunt things of criticizing Einstein. On the 75th birthday, when I showed a picture of him on the cover of Time magazine, Einstein wrote a very lovely tribute to him, claiming just what a pioneer he had been in so many different fields.
Is there a current day Tesla?
I wish. You know, the people often suggest that Elon Musk is that person. There are certainly some similarities. I mean, because Mr. Musk is, you know, thinking outside the box. You know, I mean, he's talking about going to other planets, for heaven's sakes. Yet, he also, there's a fair number of differences. I mean, Mr. Musk surrounds himself with lawyers and patent attorneys and others that sort of keep him grounded, if you will. Tesla could never really keep enough of those people around to keep him grounded. And I think I would observe that it also seems, even though he did cut 10% of his workforce, but there's a profit motive that he is consistently looking out for. And I think Tesla didn't have that. So he's the only one that sort of comes to mind, and there are a lot of similarities, but there's also some differences.
Hi.
Hi.
Might the burning of his lab have been intentional?
It doesn't appear so. It was the police reports said on the ground floor there was this sort of industrial facility that had lots of sort of old oil rags that were just, you know, hanging around. And the night watchman, at least according to the police report, dropped a cigarette and did not put it out sufficiently. And because there was all this, if you will, waste oil, particularly on the ground floor, the building just went up in flames. It actually burned the elevated, you know, line that was going next to the building. It was a horrible conflagration. And for him, you know, as I mentioned before, he lost everything. You know, all of his equipment, all of his notes. It was devastating to him. And why that's important is, but this is at the time where he and Marconi are sort of in a fight over, you know, who will claim, you know, rights to being called the father of radio. And Tesla just lost about a year trying to catch up, if you will. And although the Supreme Court, and that's why I mentioned radio at the beginning, did rule that it was Tesla's inventions that really were the foundation for radio, Marconi gets a lot of the credit in part because Tesla was sidetracked for a while. One other, if I might, other comment about this burning of his lab, it gives how alliances shifted amongst scientists at the time. So you would think George Westinghouse would be unbelievably helpful to Tesla during his time of need. Tesla made the Westinghouse company possible, in part because the bankers had somewhat taken over the Westinghouse company. George didn't have as much control over it. And so his response to Tesla's burning was to say, we're happy to give you new equipment if you pay up front for it. Yeah. But who was the one that said to Tesla, your place is burned down, come and use mine if you want it? Thomas Edison. Even though they had fought for just years, he sort of said, open the door, my lab is yours.
So you focus a lot about on the quirkiness just a little bit, you know, and so on. And everyone likes to hear stories about quirky scientists who have invented a lot of things. And I like your batting average, approach to this thing. Because Newton, for example, you know, spent a lot of time trying to decipher the Bible's numerology stuff and alchemy and other things that he, in addition to what he else did, and Einstein didn't wear socks, all those kind of things. You know, it makes people entertained, but at the same time, it's just our way of trying to say, see, aren't you glad that we're not them, right?
Well, I mean, even Thomas Edison was off. You know, he lost tons of money trying to figure out a new way or a more efficient way to mine ore or to, extract it. And so, yes, I mean, anybody that's on the cutting edge, we all make mistakes, but particularly inventors who are on the cutting edge of thinking about the future, I mean, the odds of that are, mistakes are likely.
Please. So before my question, I have to answer, Hedy Lamarr and a partner who was a comedian and musician invented frequency hopping technology by emulating how player pianos work, and it was to prevent the enemy from jamming our torpedoes. They patented it. The Navy put the patent in a vault, said, young lady, that's great. You should go out and raise war bonds. But in today's dollars, it would have been $24 million in war bonds, so she did a good job. But the patent was later rediscovered, and that's how cell phones, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth all work. The question is...
Hold it, can you come to my next lecture?
Sure. You're going to do a book on Hedy Lamarr. That'd be awesome. The question really is just a statement. Maybe you can talk a little bit about his time in Colorado Springs.
This he, as I noted, created lightning. And again, it had been reserved for nature. And his idea was that if he was able to get enough of a lightning bolt and slam it into the earth, he felt that the earth had sort of a natural electrical charge to it, and if he could figure out and manipulate the resonance or the echoes, if you will, think about a balloon and the water going back and forth in that, if he could make them synchronize, that he'd be able to transmit power throughout the Earth, and basically all of us could get a plug and plug it into the Earth and get free electrical power. So he and his lab, he and Mark Twain were able to only send these electrical charges like 65 feet. They were having a grand time, but it was only 65 feet, and he thought, I need something bigger. So they decided to move to Colorado Springs, in part because one of his lawyers said, it's nice out there. I've got this free property. I'll give you power at night from the utility company that I am involved with. So he was out there, and he was trying to figure out how to do it. This is a very interesting turning point in his life that was hard to comprehend. Well, one of the best parts was that he was shooting electrical sparks off the top of his tower. They were going like 165 feet off into the air. And he shut down the utility system for the entire area. And so he screams at the utility company, turn my power back on. And the guy comes, well, stop your experimenting. So it was a time, though the intriguing part here was that he did shoot electrical current into the ground. And there's people might have seen the movie. It's called The Prestige. And what's his name? David Bowie, I think, plays Nikola Tesla. And in that movie, there's this scene where there are, like fields of light bulbs that are lit up as a result of this charge that has been put into the Earth. That didn't happen. I know all of these Californians think it's not true in the movies, but he did. It did. I'm a Californian. I can say this. A Southern Californian. He did. I mean, the lamps did, about 20 of them, about 165 feet from the lab, did light up from the ground. And horses, from nearby, their, metal shoes, caused them to all jerk around. So, I mean, he was on to something. But the weird part was that he did not keep notes. This usually meticulous scientist, for this one period of time, he didn't have any independent verification of some of his work, which was surprising. He left Colorado Springs largely because his tower wasn't as big as he thought it needed to be, so he moved to what's now Shoreham, New York, and built a much larger tower that he thought would have a bigger charge that he could send through the Earth.
All right, there's time for one more question.
What, if anything, was his fetish with three based on?
It seems like a nice number. I don't know is the short answer. I guess you can count. The weird part is that every hotel room that he stayed in also had to be divisible by three. He was quite serious about taking walks, and he had to count. And if it didn't get divided by three, he'd do it all over again. Well, listen, thank you very much for the Commonwealth Club and for your attention today. Thank you.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thanks a lot for coming.